You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Psychobetical Podcast. I'm Andy Kirkpatrick, and this week I thought I would cover the topic of Doug Scott. Now, Doug Scott died early this year of brain cancer, I think, and I would, at the time, wasn't really doing any podcasts, so I would have done it then, but it's been on my mind that I should really sort of share a few stories about Doug Scott, really, because he was a really remarkable person. I don't think we'll see his like again. I don't think so. I guess I knew Doug Scott existed as a young climber. I knew about the Ogre and the southwest face of Everest, the Annapurna and things. I don't think I would have read any books about them, but they must have been conscious of them. And I think I was conscious from reading sort of old magazines, High Magazine, Mountain Magazine, old issues of Mountain Magazine, who Doug Scott was. So as slowly as my sort of understanding of climbing grew, then my kind of respect for Doug kind of increased. But the first time I ever actually met Doug Scott was I was working in London in an outdoor shop, and back in the day they used to have this thing called COLA, which was a what did it stand for? Camping Outdoor Leisure Association or something. And it was a big kind of event in Harrogate where all the outdoor brands would sort of get together for was it a week or a weekend or something? It was a weekend. Anyway, but they would all rock up there, and they would take over the convention center, and there'd be all this stuff. It was like Harrogate. I don't know if it's still the same, but it used to be, that was every week there'd be a new kind of convention going on in Harrogate. Apparently, the most badly behaved convention ears were the toy people. Apparently, so. Anyway, so for some reason, I'm at the company I work for. They'd send a few people up to Harrogate so they could walk around and see what was coming out and what was new. I'm sure I was only a spotty, new person working in the shop, which was soon to go bankrupt anyway. So some businesses they would send people there so they could look around and come back and report on new gear. So if you had someone working for you who was really, really nerdy, then it's an ideal place to go. And also, if you wanted to move out of like retailing, being a retailer, like a salesperson, and become a rep or work for an outdoor company, that was a place to go. Really, you could go around and sort of impress people how what a nerd you were, or how much you could drink or something. So yes, I went up on the train. I think I probably went up by myself. I went up on the train from London and arrived in Harrogate. Harrogate's kind of quite nice, really. It's a bit like York, very, very kind of fancy. So anyway, so I went around the trade show, and it was a really interesting time back then. There was a lot more UK manufacturers manufacturing in the UK. So you'd still had Carrymore, Berghaus, Phoenix. You said like a lot of companies that don't really exist anymore in that, you know, they either don't exist at all, or they don't make anything in this country anymore. But there was a lot of energy. I expect it's still the same, but in that time, you just had a lot of very old school kind of experienced people who made shit, and all of them were like really, really into whatever they did. So climbing, skiing, mountaineering, all that kind of stuff. So you'd have, you know, you'd have like, you know, Rab Carrington there, you know, selling his sleeping bags, and you'd have Pete Hutchinson doing his stuff with mountain equipment, and just all these people. So it was really interesting. You could see why the UK had this such a vibrant kind of outdoor, you know, sort of brand. Like, it was probably punching above its weight in terms of innovation and everything else. So anyway, so but at the time I'd become really obsessed with Buffalo, which is made in Sheffield, still made in Sheffield. And the guy who'd started Buffalo was a guy called Hamish Hamilton. And Hamish, he had been, it'd be great to interview him sometime, because he's a very interesting guy. But I think he was in the RAF, and he was like a radar operator or something. And then he left, and then he started designing stuff. And he designed the Force 10 tent, the cotton tent. And he made the tent orange because it was more romantic on the inside. Like, if anybody's ever, like, I'm sure some people here will have slept in a Force 10 tent, and it was just basically orange. Was it the inside was orange, like the inner tent and the fly sheet? They're all made out of orange cotton, and they were actually really, really good tents. Like, they kept the rain out, and they were bloody, you know, tough. But they didn't have a lot of room in, and they're also quite heavy. Like, the ground sheet was literally like rubber, like a rubber thing. But there is still, I expect people still use them, like, you know, expedition sort of tents and things, because they were just kind of indestructible. They just lasted forever. And then he went on and he designed other things. And he basically was one of the people, he basically invented Pertex. I don't know exactly how it happened, but basically he wanted a fabric which would act like a blotting paper. So when water hit it would, through capillary action, it would spread out right across the entire surface of the fabric, and then it would be able to like be evaporated much easier through body heat or through wind or convection and all that kind of malarkey. And so he actually went to these people who made printer ribbons. That was what their that's how they made all the money. They made printer ribbons, and I think he sort of managed to source that printer ribbon material, which I guess would it be nylon, but in much wider, you know, like multi-meter widths. And that, so began Pertex. And I think he was the first person to use Pertex, which he kind of combined with fiber pile. So you had this like wicking layer which would suck the moisture, would go through the fiber pile into the Pertex, and it would be evaporated over the surface, and it would dry super quick. And because fiber pile goes down to little tiny points, the actual points would be dry, because your body, you know, the amount of contact out of 100% of fabric on your touch on your body, maybe only like 10% of it was actually touching your body, because it was going down to these fine fiber pile points. So the your people would feel completely dry in a buffalo shirt and in like torrential rain, and then you'd like squeeze their arm, and then all the water would, you know, like rush through their claws and stuff. So it was, the water was in there, but it was just kind of your body heat was like keeping it at bay. Anyway, so for some reason I got really obsessed with buffalo. I had some buffalo clothing which I'd got when I lived in Hull, when I was just getting into sort of doing outdoory stuff, and I got some on sale or something, and my dad had given me some, and some stuff he had, and then I was always like badgering. I'd always be ringing up Hamish Hamilton and telling him how good it was and all this kind of. I was probably a bit of a stalker, like an outdoor gear stalker type person. Anyway, so I ended up coming up to Cola, and then I was like hanging around. I was looking at everything, and then but hanging around with Hamish and I think maybe that was the first time I'd met Hamish, but he looked very much like kind of like Rolf Harris kind of looking character. He always wore his buffalo shirt no matter what when it was summer, winter, whatever. So. He was kind of bespeckled, kind of cross between Fagin and Rolf Harris. So then, when the days when Rolf Harris could be mentioned, and eventually he got like some kind of ME or something from working too hard. So I think somebody else must have ran the company. I'm not sure what happened, but he kind of left the scene, which is a shame because he was a really he's a really innovative. He was a clever guy, and he was really, really stuck to his guns. Like he's a very good person to study, really, because he was only interested in absolute performance. Like he didn't think you should put like flaps over the zips because he didn't need it, and he didn't think you should. You know, if you look at a buffalo shirt, it looks like very, very simple, but it's actually like a lot of things. It's actually very, very. Complex, like the ideas behind it. Like it's designed to be simple because you don't want loads of excess seams, because where you have a seam you have multi layers of fabric, and the fabric is going to dry much more slowly and hold the moisture and everything else. So it's very, actually, a buffalo shirt, although it's maybe like 30 years old now, is still like one of the best bits of clothing I think, you know, that's ever been invented for the outdoors. So towards the end of the show, like I guess I was gonna go back to London on the last train, and Hamish was like, "Oh, do you want to come for a meal? And you can stay in the you can stay in the hotel." These days you never do that because you never know what might happen. You might give you some dodgy tagine, and you'd wake up, you know, getting raped or something. So anyway, But in those days, you know, you were young and naive, so you went along. I did get raped. No, so I said, "Oh, that's great." Yeah, so I went along to this hotel where they were staying at, and there was all these like people who there were lots of people who you'd invite to this meal who were obviously in the trade, but there was like Doug Scott. I was like, "Oh my god, that's like Doug Scott." Like, oh my god, Doug like really. Like I was once in Plassey Brennan in the climbing wall, and Doug Scott came in and he sort of took off his top, so he didn't have a top on, and he looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was like so strong. He was just this like huge brick of a man, really. And he played a lot of rugby when he was early on in his life. He was just like really, really strong. Kind of guy, just like must be naturally strong, and he sort of exudes that kind of strength, like when he's in a room and everyone's kind of drawn to him. And I remember he was telling sort of all these like stories. He's like Don Willen. He'd always have these like Don Willen kind of impersonations, and it's very hard to do it. He had some story about Don Willen saying about taking his wife to the Himalayas. Anyway, you have to do the hand things about, so anyway, so it doesn't matter. So we all went through to have our meals. Everyone was sitting on tables, and probably on purpose, I ended up sitting on Doug Scott's table. And I remember there was Doug Scott, there was this guy called Paul, this guy called Nick, and this guy called Tony, this old guy. And it turned out that the guy called Paul was Paul Braithwaite. Who was the guy who, like, Paul Braithwaite, we don't know a lot about him, but he was the guy who kind of forged through the rock band on the southwest face of Everest. So he was, you know, phenomenally strong climber. Very sort of skinny, skinny guy. You know, you wouldn't. The thing, if you ever look at Doug Scott's sort of photo book that Ken Wilson brought out, there's a really great picture of like Paul Braithwaite looking up on Mount Kenya, like looking up all wet and bedraggled. And Nick Kikas was the other guy, and Nick was like a Himalayan sort of mountain guide who eventually kind of got, I don't know what happened to him, but he got sort of embroiled in some horrible legal stuff about the British guy dying on Everest. So I don't know if he still guides and stuff. And then Tony Greenbank, who's dead now, who's a famous, he's a sort of really well-known character in like Lake District climbing, like writer, raconteur and stuff. So it was like, amazing, like just being on this table. I don't remember anything that anyone was saying anything, but it was interesting how that I felt kind of comfortable with, you know, these like sort of like, well, you know, Doug was definitely like a hero, and Paul kind of became like one of my heroes like later on, the more I knew about what he'd done. And he had some amazing stories. I think Paul Braithwaite did like the first British ascent of the Bernatti Pillar or something, and he had this story that they just slept on Montembers on like a bench, and then when they walked across the glacier and went up to the bottom of the route, and then they realized they'd left all their pitons behind or something. They had to do it without any pitons, but they did it anyway. But yeah, really interesting character. So that was like my first time of meeting Doug Scott. So I don't have any amazing recollections really, but apart from he was he kind of lived up. He wasn't like disappointing really. He was kind of funny and interesting, and always had lots of interesting things to say. And then a funny story. Then later on, I worked for Dick Turnbull outside, and Dick had this funny story about Doug Scott, in that he was invited to some Berghouse like brainstorming event up in the winter time, and there was Doug Scott and Chris Bonington, and I think Andy Cave was there, and all these quite a few like well known climbers. And the idea was they would go out climbing in the daytime, and then they would meet up in the evening and talk about gear ideas and things. And at that time, Berghouse were like really top end company. They were making just, you know, some really, really good, really, really good stuff, like top of the range kind of stuff. Not so much now. I think I worked for Berghouse for a while, and it was terrible. It was really terrible. A company like that is just all about politics. It's nothing about gear. Like they know they can make like really, really shit gear and people will still buy it because it's got Berghouse on it. Certain types of people, but they have really no cachet anymore. And I think I had this idea that I would go and work for them and I'd help them, you know, regenerate something, but it was a completely pointless exercise. But I remember like they had this big meeting, and a company like that, you have the sales force who literally could have been selling fitted kitchens the day before. Then you have like the marketing department who basically could have been marketing fitted kitchens the day before. Where before you had these people who were running these companies who were like really, really, you know, interested in, you know, really obsessive about climbing and mountaineering expeditions and all that kind of stuff. Now that doesn't really exist anymore. But remember, there was the marketing department that were talking about this big thing that they had like two kind of customers, and one was Fresh Air and one was Cool Air. So one was about like, you know, fresh air out in the outdoors, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the other one was like Cool Air, like hanging with your homies, you know, in Moss Side, wearing your Berghouse jacket, all that kind of stuff. And I was like, so I put my hand up and said, like, what about dog hair? Oh, God, it's terrible. I sometimes look back at like stuff like that. I'm like, what the interest. Interestingly, I ran. I've done quite a few kind of events where you get a load of designers together and people like that, and you take them out on the hill and stuff. And it's interesting how a lot of designers aren't actually users. They're just kind of designers. So they could be. I might have mentioned all these stories before, but you know, once worked for a company, and the guy, the design manager, I think he'd worked for like Puff Daddy or Puff Diddy or somebody. So, you know, like he, you know, and then he was like working for this, you know, company. So, you know, the design, like in this time, like in the 90s, like all those people who were designing this gear were real kind of users. So like Rab was basically designing the gear. You know, all they really were like hands-on. Like they would go on a trip and then they would come back and they'd be like, what we need is, you know, this kind of thing. So it was a lot of like innovation and a lot of like practical kind of stuff, but it slowly changed. The culture kind of changed in sort of like outdoor brands. Outdoor companies became outdoor brands, if you know what I mean. And nobody in that chain of the business, the owners, the designers, the salespeople, they could have been selling anything, designing anything, like running anything. So that's one reason why it kind of is that, you know, there are some brands that are making like really kind of niche, you know, kind of stuff, and it's still very, very hands-on. Like someone like Pod rucksacks don't exist anymore, but like Pod was just one guy making rucksacks who was like super, super keen. He wasn't like a mountaineer, but he knew lots of mountaineers like Andy Cave and Rab and all those kind of people. So that kind of fed into the rucksacks he was making. He was making some like fantastic rucksacks, like the ice, what was it called? Like ice, black ice rucksacks. They were really, really great rucksacks. And same with like Wild Things in the US and MacPack, and you know, but all those companies have basically gone. Like Pod disappeared. Wild Things is owned by some company that's basically focusing on making military gear. MacPack could be any brand. It could be Benetton. Basically, it's not what it used to be. Anyway, so I did one of these. I've done a few of these things where you got designers out, and what was interesting was, you would go up on like the Cairngorm Plateau and it'd be like really, really windy, and they'd be like walking along in their jackets. And then the like chief designer would be like, oh, I never understood why there was a wire in the hood of a jacket. And now I get it. And it was like, oh my God, like how can you be designing gear that, you know, and be just not really understand what you're doing. So anyway, but I guess it just shows it doesn't really matter really. Like, you know, it's a bit like, you know, like a website works because it's working on sort of HTML. Like might look shit and it might look whatever, but it's basically, you know, if it's kind of functioning, it's, you know, you can't make up your own, you know, sort of coding thing to produce something on it on a website. And it's the same with with clothing. As long as it's made out of some breathable waterproof material or some non-breathable waterproof material, and as long as it's made out of some kind of synthetic fiber or whatever, you know, it's gonna work. Like people used to walk around, you know, wearing just like a blanket, and you know, like you didn't need to be a designer to make a blanket. But on the story about Doug Scott was so they had this event and there was all these people staying at Plassey Brennan, and one morning a load of them, like a load of the kind of B team. So I decided to go up to like the Northern Corries, go up to Schnecta, and Doug Scott and Chris Bonington were like the A team, like Chris Bonington. I remember like Chris Bonington basically like told me off because I think Chris Bonington like vouched for me to get a job at Berghaus, and I just fucked it up basically. And I think he told me that I dropped the ball or something. It was really terrible to get like basically told off by Chris Bonington, and I did really. It's like shameful that people vouch for you and you're just like a, you know, so Chris Bonington, I think he wasn't the director, but he was one of the directors of Berghaus, so he's maybe still is, but you know, he's like very corporate. He behaves himself. He doesn't like go off shagging prostitutes and stuff and snorting cocaine, which probably like Leah Holding probably does. But that's why Leah Holding probably works for Berghaus, because they really need someone like Leah to kind of give it some sense of, you know, of what it used to be, even if it isn't. But Leah Holding is amazing. He can make like shit clothes look amazing. Like that's his apart from being a fantastic climber, Like you could dress him up in like Mattyland kind of kids' clothes or something, and he would look bloody amazing in them. So, actually, on the subject of Chris Bonington telling me off, I don't know if it's because I'm 50. Is it R.D. Lang? He said something like, if you go, the best thing about having a mental breakdown is if you get through it, you end up having amazing wisdom or something. And I think like in 2014 to 2015, I had some kind of mental breakdown kind of thing. And I like through all my life, I always had this idea that I was having like midlife crisis, but I wasn't having midlife crisis. I was just living, and that's what like actually living your life is going to create crises in your life, like decisions and things you have to deal with. Like if you're not living your life, you won't have any of those things. You're just like dead, basically, going around like a zombie. But like in 2014, I did have like a proper like something, you know, kind of lost the plot. But I think I actually, thinking back to the Chris Bonington thing and like many, many things in my life before that, before going mad and sort of coming through it and having some kind of wisdom, like the wisdom is basically fucking growing the fuck up, basically. And I was, although I was probably some kind of, you know, like people would see me as being some sort of alpha male kind of person going off climbing, doing all this kind of shit. I was like a total beta male in a way. Like I never really made that transition from being a child to an adult. And because, you know, I was like married really young and my wife was like, you know, she's like, but like, you know, lectures, you know, she's a lecturer and academic, works in social work or whatever, you know, she was like your classic modern woman who is, you know, basically wants a beta male, basically. And it's not her fault. That's the way the world is designed these days. But it means if you're like a beta male, like I'm not one of these incel people, I'm not going to go around shooting people now, but you know, like it's good to realize if someone is going to take on the role of the adult in your relationship, that it allows you to be just a fucking loser and just not take responsibility for either anything that you're gonna do or anything you have done, because it's like, well, I'm a child, you know, why should I, you know, children don't go around with wallets or have a watch or have a credit card or, you know, understand what the bills are or anything else. So you just kind of disengage from being an actual adult, from being a man, basically. So again, blaming being a beta male on being a fuck up with the Chris Bonington is also a beta male kind of thing, in that you just have to take responsibility. Like it was your fault. Like you just allowed someone else to dominate you in your life and be, you know, feckless and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if anyone here is young is listening to this, men or women, it's a good thing to like realize is the sooner you can start thinking yourself as an adult and not as a child. Like most people my age, you know, Generation X, Generation blah blah blah, they all like suffer from the same kind of thing. Like they're not fully engaging with the opportunity they've been given by being born in the world. So anyway, it's too late for me, but it's not too late for some people. So anyway, so they're the B team on this, they start walking into the Northern Corries, and the weather's like absolutely terrible. And they're walking in and they get like almost there and they go, oh, this is fucking ridiculous. Like we can't go climbing in this. This is like terrible. And if you get a load of like climbers together, you know, like sort of good climbers, no one wants to be the one who's like, oh, this is shit. Like I want to go back, you know, they'll all want to keep on going. So anyway, eventually someone's like, this is bullshit, let's just go back, this is crazy. So they all turn round and they all start walking back down the trail in this kind of semi whiteout, and then suddenly below them they see the huge hulking frame of Doug Scott and behind him like Chris Bonington, kind of like coming, like forcing the way up through this storm towards the Northern Corries, and like fuck, it's like Chris Bonington and Doug Scott, like, what are we going to do? Like, quick, hide. So they all, like, ran off the trail and kind of hid behind these rocks. And then Doug Scott and Chris Bonington like come past them, and then they like feel really shamed. Like Chris Bonington was probably at the time was probably like 60 something or something, and same like Doug Scott's a bit younger, but you know they were like old senior citizens of extreme climbing. Anyway, so they go past them and like, oh god, that's terrible. So they kind of mope down the thing, feeling totally shamed. Anyway, but the what actually happened was Chris Bonington and Doug Scott went about another 200 meters, and they were like, "This is fucking shit. Let's turn around and go home." So they did as well. So anyway, so that was my first sort of interaction with Doug Scott. And of course, I think like when you meet someone like that when you're young and stuff, it's like really is kind of amazing, you know. Although as you get older, you meet all these people and you realize that they're just people. They're just, you know, there is something about it, about meeting people early on. Maybe it's a good thing that you realize they're human and you could be, you know, as good as them or whatever. Yeah, maybe. So this the I think I ended up. So I eventually ended up like, you know, being. You know, this is when I first met him, I was an absolute nobody. And then, you know, life progressed and I started doing more kind of climbing and you know, doing harder stuff, and ended up sort of having a sort of a career doing talks about my adventures and stuff. And I was invited to the Fort William Film Festival when it first started up in Scotland. And Chris Bonington Doug Scott was also talking there. And we ended up like staying in the same hotel, and he was staying there with his two kids who he had like young, like a bit. But one interesting about Doug Scott was he was like a lot of people. I don't mean, have you ever seen the film Beware of Mr. Baker about Ginger Baker? Like that is one of the best documentaries I think anyone's ever made. Absolutely fantastic documentary. Basically about someone who is a master in his art, but like an absolute fucking fuckwit in everything else, like in his life, and just like someone said like Ginger Baker as a drummer, you know, he taught me everything as a man. He like taught me nothing or something. Doug Scott was a little bit like that. Like he had like loads of failed marriages and divorces and kids and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, kind of a product of that generation, really, is a hippie. Like there's that famous story where someone said because Doug had like long hair and he used to wear like round glasses, and someone said, oh, you look like John Lennon, and he said, no, John Lennon looks like me. So which could be true, because, you know, Chris was like, I mean, oh god, why come with Chris? Anyway, Doug was, you know, kind of getting famous in that period of the 60s, and so he could have you know, there's like Mick Jagger was a rock climber, which is kind of interesting. Before he was famous, he was into rock climbing. So we ended up at this thing, and I ended up having, I was a bit, you know, you're always a bit shy, but there was only me and Doug and his kids in this whole hotel. So I ended up going and sort of sitting with Doug. I think we were there for like 2 or 3 days, and we would just we'd have our breakfast together at the same time. And like Doug was like just such an interesting guy. Like he just had so many interesting stories and stuff to do with climbing, stuff to not do with climbing. I remember he told me this story. Do you know Mallory and Irving? Like when they maybe climbed Everest, he had this story that he'd been told by someone else that Mallory's wife or Irving's wife, like when they died on Everest, that his wife was staying over with somebody. And when she came down in the morning, she said, like, I had, like, in the night, like, Mallory, like, came to me in a, you know, like, his ghost came to me, and he was telling me all the things he wanted me to do with the children and all the, you know, and where the documents were and his will and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and it was like he was totally in the room with me. And then she said, in fact, I'm going to go back to bed now. I'm so tired. So she's walking away. And then someone said, did he do it? And she said, of course he did. Anyway, so that little stories like that, you're telling stories like that. And just stories about, you know, people and climbers and stuff. Like Doug's actual like lecturing ability, like he was basically fucked. Like his hip was fucked from probably from the ogre, and he walked like his leg was basically bent. Like he just walked like a, he was basically like a cripple. He kind of could hardly walk anywhere, and you could just see he was like really, really beaten up, really. And beaten up by life as well, probably beaten up by his marriages and things like that. He was basically, I think he, I got the impression he was basically homeless and penniless or something. He was, he'd not come out well from his, like relationships and all the money he must have made in the past from doing stuff. But yeah, his like lecturing style, he would just like get up on this like stool and he would start telling these stories about Everest, but it was good if you'd never heard them, and it was good if you were really into Himalayan climbing, but he wasn't really a performer. You know, he's like, oh, this is you know, North Face of Chakmandu. Oh yeah, we'd climb this with so-and-so, and then so-and-so died or something. And then he'd be like, this is the. It was a bit like that. And someone told me they once went to a slideshow where there was loads of drunk people there, like loads of drunk students. And they all started, they just started getting the giggles when every time he said someone died, everyone would start giggling. And then it got worse and worse. And then the Doug was kind of, you know, he just didn't notice. And he told me he did a lecture somewhere, and he went on so long that eventually they just switched off the slide projector. And he was just like, oh, I guess that's it. I guess that's the end. And he just walked off the stage. So, one of the funniest stories, he did the Paul Nunn Memorial Lecture in Sheffield. And I don't know if they still do the Paul Nunn Memorial Lecture, but it was quite good. I once did it with, it was me and Joe Simpson did like a lecture. And he was doing this lecture and he was going on and on and on and on and on. And everyone was just like, oh, Christ, like, when's this going to end? And he started, and he got into like the topic of the seven summits. And he's going, the number seven, it's an interesting number, the number seven. The seventh sign, seven brides, you know, what was that? You know, just like going about number seven, and then someone just shouted from the audience, 7 minutes till closing time, and then everyone burst out laughing, and then they all just started getting up and just like leaving the venue, and again, Doug was like, oh, I guess that's it. So, but like sometimes he could be really good. He just told the same stories like a billion times, and you know, it just you know, yeah, seven brides for seven brothers. One funny story someone told me about Doug was Doug won the Empire Medal because he was the first British, you know, him and Dougal Haston. Well, he was the first Englishman, I guess. He was the first Englishman, I think, to climb Everest. Because Mallory was New Zealander, so you know, Southwest Face of Everest, like amazing, amazing thing. So I think he got the Empire Medal, which is like a gold medal, which is, you know, like really, really, you know, it's like getting like it's a much bigger thing than getting like an OBE or something. I don't know if he was he ever Sir Doug Scott, not sure. But anyway, so Doug got this Empire Medal, got solid gold. You know, this is like amazing, like winning just an amazingly thing. Anyway, so one day someone was at his house and the kids were like playing around, you know, going crazy like in his house, and the toys were everywhere. And he looked into the toy box where all the kids' toys were. In the bottom of the toy box was the Empire Medal, which I thought was like a really Chris Bonington kind of thing. I think eventually one of his wives took the medal and melted it down, and to get the gold for the money, which is a sort of sad story. like Doug, later on, like in life, like I had quite a lot of dealings with Doug, and Doug would. Because it was Doug Scott, like if he asked you to do something, you would always basically do it because it was like Doug Scott. So he had this charity, CAN, which was, what did it stand for? CAN, I don't know what it stood for. Anyway, Asian Network something, charity in Asia. Anyway, so he was like building schools and hospitals in Himalayas, in Nepal. So you know, he would ask you to do a talk for him, and I did like a, I did a tour, and it was me, Simon, not Simon Kennedy, Alex Huber, what's his name? Thingy Kennedy, who started Climbing Magazine, Michael Kennedy. Michael Kennedy, he was very dry. He was very American. He was very like, you know, he wasn't very emotional. He wasn't a performer on stage. And I once did a talk in Boulder, Colorado for Alpinist Magazine. I think it was, I probably told this story, but there was Michael Kennedy, then it was me, then it was Jimmy Chin. This was before Jimmy Chin, anyone really knew who Jimmy Chin was. And anyway, Michael Kennedy came up and he did this talk and everyone was talking and it was like really, really, they couldn't hear what he was saying. And it was like, he was probably talking about something amazing, but no one could really hear what he was talking about. He just wasn't engaging with the audience. Then I got up and I was like, shut the fuck up, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was like, everyone started listening to what I was saying. So it was like, it went down really well, my talk. And anyways, then Jimmy Chin came on and he just played some reggae music. He didn't say anything. And then, then I was like talking to someone at the bar, you know, and I was like, what do you think to the night? I said, oh God, Michael Kennedy. Like, you know, he was a bit shit, wasn't he? And he was like, oh, I'm Michael Kennedy. But he just said it was just a really crestfallen, like, oh, that was me. So anyway, so I did a tour with Doug Scott and it was funny because that, it was Alex Huber. Yeah, Alex is like very Germanic and he comes across as quite serious. He's, is he not from the Tyrol? I can't remember. It's very Germanic, basically. And I remember, like, because mine was kind of funny, my slideshow. And to begin with, it was like I was the second person, and then eventually they put me on as the main person because it was really funny my talk. And then Alex would come on; it wouldn't be as funny, and it would just create a weird imbalance to the evening, really. So I was there just at entertainment value, nothing to do with how good you are, which is probably not easy for Alex because Alex was like a superhero. So. It's a bit like Batman and Robin, and say, can Robin go on after Batman? So I remember Alex was like, yes, I'm very funny in German. So in Germany. Doug would ask you to do all these things and you would never be able to refuse. But generally, like most of the time, they were absolutely a disaster. Like no one would turn up or it would just, you know. I remember I missed like my daughter's, like 16th birthday because I'd agreed to do this talk for Doug Scott in London. It was just a disaster, and it wasn't good. But then he'd ask you again, and you'd go and do it again, and you know, you'd bend over backwards to help him, and because it was like for a good cause, and it was for Doug, and Doug was always really, it was kind of just cool to be able to hang out with Doug, even if it was only you and Doug, and nobody else was there. Probably one of the best stories to sort of sum up how Doug was, really, was at one time he asked someone if he would give him a lift to the airport. So he was like, Doug was living in the Lake District and he had his friend who would like help him do stuff. So the guy like turns up and he fills up the car and they start driving down to Manchester Airport, which is, you know, like an hour and a half away, 2 hours. They're driving down the motorway. You know, 2 hours later, he's coming towards the airport, the turn off of the airport, Manchester Airport, it's there, Manchester Airport. The guy starts signalling and Doug's like, no, Heathrow, which if you don't know, Heathrow is like another like 3 hours away or something. It's like a 10 hour round trip to take him to Heathrow Airport. So, you know, but again, you could never really hold it against Doug because he was just the way he was, really. I'm sure it'd be the same if you had, you know, like Bob Dylan in your car or something, you know, like it would have been like 5 hours with Doug in the car wouldn't be a chore, but the 5 hours coming home again without him in your car would be a bit of a ball ache. I think in some ways, like Doug, he actually kind of became maybe a little bit gentrified in his later life. Like he could play that game of being a gent in a way, like he would, you know, like he was a very sort of scruffy kind of rugby shirt kind of guy. But then towards later in his life, he definitely had a phase. Maybe he sort of got his shit together, like in his real life. And like I don't know if he got remarried, but he definitely was with his partner who was very stable, and he got into gardening. I think the last thing he ever told me that he just had like 2 tons of soil delivered to his house or something. And I was like, oh God, that's it. Game over now. He'd be getting to fucking bed watching and, you know, like watercolors next. And, but he definitely, towards the end of his life, he definitely had a period where he was more stable and more happy. And I guess that is that's kind of nice to see. Like people don't, want people like Doug Scott to die with their plastic boots on, but in a way, I kind of got a sense that he in a way was found some kind of inner peace. Like he was a very kind of Zen Buddhist kind of guy, like a northern, you know, from Nottingham kind of version. But he definitely seemed to, get some sort of peace and stability. And I think it was the last talk I ever did for him, it was at the Royal Geographical Society in London. And afterwards, like me being a beta male, I just turned up and didn't have anywhere to stay or whatever. After it, I just kind of think I was just going to just wing it or whatever. So we kind of come out and Doug's like, we went for this meal. And then Doug's like, where are you staying? I'm like, oh, I don't really have anywhere to stay. And he said, oh, you can stay at my club. Like, who would think that the Doug Scott would say, you can stay at my club? So we end up getting this taxi. We end up going to the Sloan Club, which is, you know, like, I don't know if it's still, maybe it's still there, but, you know, private members club. Yeah, never, like, the idea of me being a private members club. And, you know, went in there and he got me this room. And then in the morning, you know, you go down, everyone's having the breakfast. And in this breakfast area, it was like the after party from some party the Great Gatsby would have thrown, but with all the guests being like 100 years old and everyone was just decrepit and people be going for, I think Doug probably had like a shirt and tie and a jacket on, you know, for his breakfast, and I just had a t-shirt on. I made the massive faux pas of having a mobile phone as well. That's like, you're not allowed to have mobile phones in the Sloan Club. So I think that was kind of my last dealings with him. And the last sort of anecdote I had was someone told me, like Doug was a man of his age, basically. Like he created a lot of problems. Like he didn't like bolting. He didn't want British mountaineering to be involved, BMC to be involved in like competitive climbing, Olympic climbing. And he was a real, he created like a lot of, like people just want everything to be nice and smooth and everyone to agree and everything. But Doug was like a stone in everyone's plans, basically. And, you know, you had like, before you, Doug, you had like Ken Wilson. You had these people who really, you know, were like sand in the cogs, basically, you know, of progress. But that's really what you need in climbing. I think these days you don't have it anymore. People are like, oh, do what you want. I don't really care. You know, I'm just going to bolt up the whole of Stanage. Oh, I don't really care. Don't climb there anymore. And anyway, so this is kind of a funny story, because this probably shows why, you know, Doug was probably on borrowed time in this modern world of cancel culture, in that someone rang him up and it was the headmistress of some famous private girls school in London, and they said, Mr. Scott, we'd love you to come and do a, you know, like a slideshow for us, and you know, we'll give you like, you know, lots of money for your charity and stuff. And he was like, oh, that'd be great. That'd be great. Oh, great, great stuff. And they were like, would you be able to send us an email, you know, with all your, all your details and stuff? He's like, oh, no, I don't write emails. That's woman's work. And the person just put the phone straight down on him. So that's Doug Scott, really. But I just thought I'd read you in my book, down book, the last, there's like a little epilogue, an epilogue. Anyway, it's like a last word, and I'll just read you this because it kind of, it's to do with, like, you know, meeting Doug Scott like all those years ago. I come down the stairs for breakfast. It's winter, so the small hotel is all but empty. The dining room is almost silent, the only sound the gurgle of melting snow escaping the roof down the drain pipe, and the clicking cutlery of a single diner, the hotel's only guest, God himself. He greets me with, "Morning, youth," as I pull up the chair and sit beside him, a little intimidated to be alone with such a man as this. He asks me if I want some of his tea, lifts up the hot metal pot with a large butcher's hand, and begins to pour before I reply. As the tea pours, I look at his thinning white hair, grey stubble, his imperfections, notice how battered his body is, think how I've seen him walking on the stage in the film festival last night, barely able to hobble on his one good knee. And yet, sat opposite him now, you could still see the body of a rugby player, a fighter, someone with the physical capacity to scale the southwest face of Everest, Changabang, Nanga Parbat, and all the others, and the physical and mental capacity to come back. I order my breakfast, meat to his veggie, and we talk about food for a while, not mountains. Then I tell him about an idea for a book I want to write, a book about descent, a book that would eventually take me 20 years to write. He begins to share a story of climbing Shishkapangma with Alex and Roger, now long dead, how they were going alpine style, how they were really pushing it, strung out and exposed. He tells me now, when they reached the summit, he felt he had very little left in the tank, yet they were only halfway, and now had to down climb the route, steep and deadly. As I was down climbing, I went into a dream state. I imagined my mother at home, looking at my kids, sat in the living room, telling them, "Don't worry, your dad is being so careful. He's taking care with every single step he takes." That image, those words, was all I could think about, and that's what I did. I focused on every single step, all the way down. It's a great privilege to take tea with God, to heed his words, and so grow old and tell such stories. Thank you very much. That's it for this week's podcast. Any more news? I'm on tour soon, so check that out on my website. With Speakers from the Edge, look on Speakers from the Edge. And Pete Whittaker is also going to be on tour soon. He's going to finish up the tour he was doing before the deadly C word appeared. And I'm going to try and get Pete Whittaker on the podcast to talk about Pete Whittaker kind of stuff. So until then, I'll see you soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.